Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Eben Osnos, a staff writer with The New Yorker since 2008, who previously reported from China and Iraq for the Chicago Tribune, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. He joins us to discuss his new book, just out, Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now, and offer his insights into who the 46th President of the United States is and what has shaped the life of a politician who has been described as the luckiest and the unluckiest of men. After suffering deep personal losses and disappointments along with the triumph of eventually succeeding in the goal he had as a young man, Biden has now become President of the United States. Having spent a lot of time with Biden, Eben Osnos recounts how when Trump refused to commit to a peaceful transition and equated Democratic votes with fraud, Biden told him, quote, "I feel good about where we are, but I know it's going to get really, really ugly." Then we'll examine how Trump's Operation Warp Speed task force is being prevented from communicating with Biden's new COVID-19 task force, which could mean 150,000 Americans will die needlessly between now and January the 20th due to the lack of logistical coordination in distributing vaccines and accessing inventories of PPE, etc. With estimates that by February the 1st we will have 400,000 deaths by COVID, we'll speak with Dr. Stanley Perlman, a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa. He has studied coronavirus pathogenesis for decades and joins us to discuss America's deadly vacuum of leadership with Trump holed up in the White House watching TV and stewing over the final election results going against him and feeling betrayed that foreign leaders like his friend Boris Johnson are calling Biden to congratulate him. Meanwhile, as the pandemic rages out of control, there is no government plan or policy to deal with it, and the incoming administration, which will be left holding the bag, is unable to coordinate with the Department of Health and Human Services, which Trump has tasked to find out why Pfizer announced its vaccine a week after the election in an act Trump considers treachery by Deep Pharma. Then finally, we will assess the alarming growth of the rates of infections and deaths in the United States as Tuesday's one-day total of infection of 136,000 was surpassed by Wednesday's total of 144,000, and speak with an expert on how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experiences of the adult population. Mark Hayward, a professor of sociology and a research associate at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas and a member of the Committee on Population at the National Academy of Sciences, joins us to discuss the growing death toll and how it can be reversed. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Eben Osnos, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008 and previously reported from China, Iraq, and elsewhere for the Chicago Tribune, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. His previous book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, won the National Book Award. And his latest book just out is Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eben Osnos.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And at the time when Donald Trump was refusing to commit to a peaceful transition and was equating Democratic mail-in votes with fraud, in a conversation you had with Joe Biden, he said, "I feel good about where we are." And then he said, "But I know that it's going to get really, really ugly." Well, boy, is that an understatement.
Yeah, I'd say he had a fairly precise preview of what we're dealing with now. I don't think there's much about this that has shocked him. And it's part of the reason why you hear a mood of calm coming out of President-elect Biden and the people around him. They more or less gamed this out and sensed this is what Trump was going to do.
But some Democratic critics are suggesting that Biden is bringing a butter knife to a gunfight. and given that Senator Thune let the cat out of the bag by admitting that the Republican senator's strategy is to basically use Trump to rile up the base all the way through the runoffs in Georgia, which end on January the 5th of 2021, just 2 weeks before Biden's inauguration. So does that mean we're really going to have a scorched earth environment all the way up till January the 5th?
I think we are likely to have a fairly brutal atmosphere in politics all the way through the Georgia runoff, because from the Republican perspective, that's their last stand against the possibility of Democrats controlling both the Congress and the presidency. I will say that, interestingly, Biden has been accused of bringing a butter knife into war a few times over the course of the campaign, going all the way back to the beginning when he would take a sort of soft-edged approach in dealing with some of his own opponents within the party during the primary. His view at the moment, and this is true up until all the way through last night, I was talking to somebody on the campaign who was saying to me, and now in the transition, was saying to me, look, at this point, we don't see a real legal play for Trump here. It's not as if there is some avenue that he can actually exploit that could affect the outcome of the race. And as long as that's true, their approach is not to participate in the fiction. Don't dignify this invention of a dispute where a dispute does not exist. You know, they are in the fortunate position right now of holding the stronger hand, and what they don't want to do is allow Donald Trump's anxieties and agitation to set the narrative for what really needs to be 70 days of discussion about getting the United States out of the miserable predicament we're in.
But back in 2016, most people didn't expect Trump to win. And had he lost, I'm pretty sure that he would have gone around the country for the last 4 years leading rallies of lock her up, lock her up.
Yeah.
What's to stop him from doing the same with Biden's 4 years? In other words, running around the country leading rallies of lock him and Hunter up.
I expect he probably will. I mean, that is his brand. That is his occupation now. Donald Trump lives at this strange intersection of entertainment and government. But his natural home is entertainment. He was always a strange visitor in the realm of politics. It never suited him. He never particularly liked it. And he won, of course, by this slender margin. He now has created something that didn't have a name before, which is Trumpism, but it was picking up these undercurrents in American political life that have not gone away and will exist for him after he leaves. The thing I think he doesn't perhaps fully anticipate is the way in which power here in Washington, where I am, has a way of ebbing away quite efficiently from people who no longer have the tools of the instruments of authority at their disposal. He loses all of that. And it's not a perfect analogy by any means, but Sarah Palin was for a while a person in American political life who had some of that strange charisma, this ability to kind of cast a spell over large numbers of people. And she ended up occupying more or less the realm of farce. And I think Trump will follow a trajectory that is going to be complicated. Yeah, he has some serious legal problems in his future. That's not a mystery. He'll be contending with those. That'll probably give him strength in the eyes of some of his most zealous supporters. But he'll become a different thing. He won't be a political artifact in quite the same way as he will be a kind of pop culture artifact. And look, I think we're all thinking, okay, is he going to try to run in 2024? Sure, he could try to run in 2024. But let's remember, there are a lot of other Republicans, young, ambitious, up-and-coming types, who are taking their own aim at that office and are not going to quietly wait for him to run its course.
Sure, and Pompeo comes to mind. And again, I'm speaking with Eben Osnos, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008 and previously reported from China, Iraq, and elsewhere for the Chicago Tribune, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. His previous book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, won the National Book Award. And his latest book just out is Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. So Trump, it seemed, always sort of knew that Biden was his most formidable opponent. I mean, why did he go through all that trouble with Ukraine, which ended up with his impeachment? So is that your understanding, that Trump knew all along that Biden, even though maybe the Democrats didn't think so, Trump knew that he was his most formidable opponent?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you didn't see Donald Trump suborning Ukrainian officials to try to generate dirt on Elizabeth Warren or on Bernie Sanders. That he recognized early on that Biden occupied this place on the political spectrum that posed a kind of mortal threat to Trump's politics. And interestingly, of course, you know, in my business here in the political press in Washington, a lot of people were slower to recognize that because he is not the glamorous politician who seizes the attention. Biden is slower on the stage than he would have been a few years ago. That's not a description of cognitive health, I should say. That's just a fact of how he operates. He's also not the one on social media. He doesn't care about Twitter. He's also somebody that we've kind of built into our models of American politics. We all kind of knew him. And for that reason, he wasn't the shimmering new frontier. So for that reason, I think the political press was slower to recognize something that Biden actually knew from the beginning. And the whole theory of the case for him was, if you look at surveys of Democrats, they are more likely to describe themselves as moderate or conservative Democrats than they are as progressive Democrats. And that ended up being the thing that lifted him to the top of the party and ultimately into the White House.
So did he sandbag the other Democratic contenders, or is that the way it worked out?
Well, I think the other Democratic contenders had, in a sense, the right estimation of where the party will be in 4 or 5 years. It is going to be a more liberal, younger, more progressive party. That the demographics are powerful evidence of that, and the trend within the party is clearly that. But I think they misread the degree to which Biden had these assets that were powerful against somebody like Donald Trump. And he did somewhat surprise the field, I think.
So turning to your book, Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now, he was elected to the Senate at an extraordinary young age of 29. And shortly thereafter, there was a terrible car accident that killed his wife and his young daughter, along injuring his two boys. Was he in the car?
He was not. He was in Washington that day, getting his Senate set. He was right in the middle of setting up his office. And the phone call came in to his office there in Washington, and it was his brother calling from home in Delaware. And his brother asked to speak to Biden's sister, Valerie, who was there in the office with him. And Biden remembers looking at Valerie's face, and something in her expression was so catastrophic that he sensed in his chest that something had happened. He actually said out loud, "She's dead, isn't she?" of his wife. And, you know, I have to tell you, Ian, that story, interestingly, I'd interviewed Biden about it before I had children myself. And I think, you know, I could intellectually understand it. I could understand the trauma of that as a literary matter. And now I have two kids, and it affects me in a slightly different way, because even when I'm putting on my cold, hard political analyst hat, thinking about how he was assaulted by that moment and how he had to decide whether or not to carry on in politics and how that changed him has weighed on me quite heavily as an ingredient in understanding how he changed as a person. Because that turns out actually to be in some ways the hidden fact about him that we didn't talk about enough when we were counting him out of politics. He is a changed person, and that turns out to be more powerful.
Well, there's no greater nightmare for a parent to lose a child before the parent dies. And you mentioned Valerie, his sister. She's his number one political advisor, and she basically runs his campaigns, doesn't she?
She does, up until the current one. She wasn't formally part of this campaign, but she is always at the heart of the matter. And she, you can rest assured that if Valerie Biden Owens tells you something about her brother's thinking, that it's accurate. So all of us who are paying attention, pay attention to what Val thinks.
So you mentioned that Biden's sort of motto, if you will, is failure at some point in your life is inevitable, but giving up is unforgivable. What about his Catholic faith? Because, you know, you have a very strange kind of power. Well, first of all, let's look at the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Six conservative Catholics now form the majority, the conservative mm-hmm. majority, and they're all chosen by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. So is there a possibility that there will be a discussion about Catholicism? I mean, going back to Jack Kennedy, it was, mm-hmm. he broke the mold there. But it seems so extraordinary to have so much power in the hands of ultra-conservative Catholics, particularly with the Supreme Court, that doesn't reflect the diversity within American religion, let alone within the Catholic Church.
It is a curious fact of the current moment that we do have this concentration of Catholic members of the court, and now we have the second Irish Catholic in American history to occupy the presidency. But I would draw a pretty sharp distinction between the way that Biden practices his faith and the role that it plays in the lives of some of those justices. I mean, in Biden's case, it is personally important. It's sincere. It's deeply held. I mean, he is somebody who has been in the church since his childhood. It was important to his parents. He has talked about, to me and others, about the ways in which his faith has helped him, and also at some moments has failed him in some sense, has been unsatisfying as a source of answers. I mean, after that terrible car accident, he said, "I was raised to believe in a benevolent God, and I found nothing in the scripture that would help me in those moments." So he comes to it as a kind of, as somewhat of a tested and a tempered believer. But more importantly, from a political perspective, it's not foremost in his calculation. So, for instance, he is obviously in favor of abortion rights, unlike the Catholics on the Supreme Court. And that's important. But it does situate him in a tradition of American thinking and philosophy that is obviously a world apart from where Donald Trump was. Donald Trump does not read in the way that we think of that, meaning he's not a part of these kinds of kind of this long-running patrimony of ideas and both secular and religious that shape the American character. That's never been anything that means anything to Trump. Biden, you know, almost to a fault, Biden is a quoter of the texts, and he really does. He relies on everybody from the Irish poets to Tocqueville to the Greeks. He'll talk about it. And that some of that is a little bit ostentatious. It's a bit of the habit of the autodidact that he brings that stuff up. But for him, it really does shape how he thinks.
So in terms of Democrats running for president, obviously there's no sort of back room of kingmakers anymore, if there ever was, but there certainly isn't nowadays. And you could make the argument that had Obama stepped aside back when he ran against Hillary Clinton and let her run, or if the party bosses had decided it was her turn and not his, he was a younger guy, and then he gets the next shot, which would mean he'd be president now, not Trump. Biden toyed with a run. I don't know whether when she was in trouble, HRC, and the impression I got was that they were firing a shot across the bow to get her act together in terms of her failing campaign. What's your understanding about what happened then? Because I know, we know since 1987, and so, well, actually since his first date with the wife who died, he told the mother that someday he'll be president of the United States. So it's always been on his mind.
Yeah, it's been a piece of his imagination ever since he was a teenager. Essentially, he, you know, as a teenager, he had this terrible stutter, and he was able to break the back of it by learning some techniques. And the fact that he then became able to speak to public groups gave him this kind of, there was a slingshot effect that he became much more confident about himself and began to imagine being in politics and started to talk about the idea he might want to be president. You then follow that up through the fact that he had these two failed runs for the presidency in 1987 and 2008. And then the moment comes in 2015, 2016, when he is again in the position of perhaps running for president. I mean, there's a natural logic to it. Oftentimes, the vice presidents do follow their presidents into office, or at least they run. And then there was a disruption in the pattern because Barack Obama signaled to Joe Biden privately that he really did think that it was Hillary Clinton's turn. It was not Biden's moment. And that was tense, actually. I mean, they were very close. President Obama and President-elect Biden have a very intense personal relationship as a result of working together in the White House. And this was an area of significant difference. And President Obama basically believed that it was time for America to make history again by having the first woman president. He also thought, and this is probably never quite explicitly described to Biden this way, but the truth was Obama had a certain meeting of the minds with Hillary. They're both intellectual in ways that's a little different than the way Biden operates. They spoke the same language. So Obama let it be known to Biden that he didn't think it was a great idea. He also worried that if Biden lost, it would be an embarrassing coda on this long career in public service. So, but ultimately, I think the larger piece of the puzzle, the thing that prevented Biden from running in 2016, he actually decided already in 2015 not to run, but the thing that was decisive was he had just lost his second child. His son, Beau, had died of a brain tumor. And he was undone by that. And one of his closest advisors, Mike Donilon, remembers being in a meeting at Biden's house and just looking at his face and seeing the wreckage and saying, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't run. And Mike Donilon looks back on it now and thinks, you know, I think he still could have won. I really do. And history would be a little different had he won and beaten Donald Trump. But there was just too much there for them to go forward.
Well, just in closing, Evan Osnos, let's talk a little about Biden's health. He'll be 78 soon, and certainly the oldest U.S. president. He did have two brain aneurysms, and he very close to death. In fact, the doctors called the priest in for the last rites. So you've spent time with him, and he seems like he's pretty vigorous. I mean, when he stepped up to the mic to announce, mm-hmm. acknowledge his victory, he was sort of, you know, skipping like a, you know, featherweight boxer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've been struck by how much the story of his age and his kind of mental fitness has become a piece of our public furniture that we're talking about. No, it's understandable. I mean, he is definitely 77 years old, and that is, you see that in the way he carries himself. But I have to tell you that anybody who spends time with him in any kind of serious way, like if you're having a real in-depth conversation, you come away with absolutely no question that this man is unchanged. I mean, his mind is unchanged. I've been talking to him on and off since 2014, and there is no difference in the pattern of his speech and the ways that it's described. I mean, the way that he expresses himself. I mean, for this book, I ended up including some segments of our interviews on the audiobook edition, precisely because we've played some on the radio in the U.S., and part of it was that I think people who hear it find something quite interesting in hearing the timbre of his voice in a moment when he's talking, not in a soundbite on a stage, but actually in a kind of intensive environment like that. And it's quite revealing. I tend to rely on the words of the doctors on this one, which is his most recent physical exam described him as a vigorous, healthy man of his age. But, you know, he's not 37. Personally, I think if I'm in decent shape as he is when I'm 77, I'll consider it a triumph.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Evan Osnos.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Evan Osnos, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008 and previously reported from China, Iraq and elsewhere for the Chicago Tribune, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. His previous book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth and Faith in the New China, won the National Book Award. And his latest book just out is Joe Biden, The Life, The Run and What Matters Now. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining how Trump's Operation Warp Speed Task Force is being prevented from communicating with Biden's new COVID-19 task force.
I've been first and last. Look at how the time goes past. But I'm all alone at last, rolling home to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Stanley Perlman, a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa, who has studied coronavirus pathogenesis for four decades. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stanley Perlman.
Thank you.
So we are in a peculiar state of limbo here with this transition where President Trump has yet to concede a defeat, which means that Trump's Operation Warp Speed Task Force is being prevented from communicating with Joe Biden's new COVID-19 task force. And according to estimates, this could result in 150,000 Americans dying needlessly between now and January the 20th due to the lack of logistical coordination in distributing vaccines and accessing inventories of PPE, etc. So, to my mind, it's bad enough having this ridiculous political standoff, but that's just unconscionable.
I agree with you. I don't know that we would prevent all these deaths even if we had good communication, but certainly not having good communication is a really bad idea.
And on top of that, apparently, the Biden task force can't talk to the Department of Health and Human Services, and Trump apparently has tasked HHS to find out why Pfizer announced its vaccine a week after the election in what he considers an act of treachery by Deep Pharma. So that's where his focus is. But I guess the American people be damned.
Well, this isn't totally new, so it's very unfortunate, for sure. We knew that these companies were going to hit the right number, but we didn't know when. They could have reached the right number of people to meet the criteria for thinking about an EUA. They could have met it 2 weeks ago, may have taken till mid-December or even January 1st. But the huge increase in numbers of cases has made it so they've reached it when they did reach it. But if we had kept going at the rate in October, we might not have reached it until the end of December. So I don't think there's anything nefarious here.
So is there anything that the medical community can do to find a way to, I mean, let's start with this premise, which appears to be the case. There just is no leadership, right? This pandemic is in charge and the U.S. government is kind of dead in the water.
Yeah, that's been true for the whole time, basically, with a few exceptions, but that's been true a lot of the time.
I know it's due to Trump's incompetence, but how much of a role has this Dr. Scott Atlas at the Hoover Institution, who's a radiologist now who has Trump's ear, has he played in this? I mean, he's clearly made things worse, but he apparently is basically got Trump convinced that herd immunity is the way to go. And I don't know whether that sort of suits Trump, because it's sort of, you know, the way to get herd immunity is to do nothing about the pandemic, which is basically what Trump has done. So I don't know whether it's just convenient for him to agree with that, or actually he believes in herd immunity. But what's your sense of the influence of Scott Atlas, the radiologist?
Well, I think it's really what you said. I think that he probably thinks, or it sounds like he thinks similarly to Trump does. And at the same time, I think that Trump trusts him because he thinks similarly to him. So I think it's a synergistic relationship. I think if somebody disagrees with the president, then he either denounces them or ignores them.
So, and of course, Fauci has to have armed guards protecting him and his family. And Stephen Bannon, Trump's former election guru, he has called for Fauci's beheading.
Yeah, which is really ridiculous because Fauci's been the most objective and influential person telling really the U.S. Public exactly what's going on. It's really unfortunate. Fauci's been doing this for so many years, even back in the 80s when he convinced President Reagan that taking HIV seriously was really an important thing to do. So he's very, very even keeled and apolitical and just telling it the way it is.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stanley Perlman, a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa, who has studied coronavirus pathogenesis for four decades. So as a scientist, Dr. Perlman, have you noticed a kind of war on science? I mean, let me frame it another way. Over the decades of your work, have you ever thought that a large percentage of the American people would turn against science and become hostile?
No, in the past, science has been pretty objective and just saying what they, all the data led to, and it's become much worse when a political motivation is put on everything. It just becomes really hard because things are not trusted, and then it becomes harder for scientists to do their job. It's been a little less of a problem in the biomedical field, at least until the pandemic occurred. It's been certainly a bigger problem in other aspects of science, like climate science, where it's really been a problem for 4 years now.
So how is Biden then going to convince the American people that they should wear masks and that they should practice social distancing, et cetera, particularly as we have in, 2 weeks' time, we have Thanksgiving, where apparently the advice from public health professionals is that it's not a good idea for college kids to come home from universities to meet with their parents and grandparents on the basis that these Thanksgiving dinners, family reunions, may become super spreader events.
Yep, that's certainly a concern. I think a lot of the recent outbreaks haven't really involved colleges that much. They've been a little better protected than the general population, but putting several people in the same room and having them not wear masks and not social distancing, which is usually what happens at Thanksgiving. I mean, you don't go to Thanksgiving to stay 6 feet away from everyone else and wear a mask. So all the recommendations are absolutely spot on, that this is a setup for having major outbreaks when people return to school and other people at the dinner return to work. So it's really hard. The other part is that this whole business with vaccination, because if you start having a sense that scientists and doctors are doing things for the wrong reason or not really being straight, then the American public may have questions about taking vaccines. Now, I think actually the recent data from Pfizer implying that all in preliminary, no data seen yet, suggesting that the vaccines were going to be very, very efficacious, may do go a long way to changing some of the skepticism about science and about what physicians are saying. So I hope that'll reverse things. But all the rest is, if you have a polarized country, it just seems like one side says white, the other side says black, and it becomes impossible to have people agree on commonalities.
Well, the estimates are that by February the 1st, there'll be 400,000 deaths in this country from the coronavirus pandemic. And I suspect that very shortly thereafter, the Republicans will begin to blame President Biden for the pandemic. So what's it going to take to break this kind of logjam between the dangers of this pandemic growing exponentially and the amount of denial in the country?
Yeah, it is hard. I think the first thing you have to do is have a president who's saying we have a real problem and we have to deal with it. That would help a lot. And then at that point, we have to work on convincing people who are skeptical about government in general and skeptical about these recommendations that they actually have some value. And that would, if that would be helped by if governors in states where a lot of these people live all supported the idea of wearing masks and social distancing. I think governors are coming around. Republican governors tend to be more interested in letting people make their own decisions and considering economic issues. But the fact is that if you let the virus get out of hand, it doesn't matter what you think economically, there's still going to be a disaster. You're not going to be able to have a normal economy with everybody, with so huge numbers of people getting sick and people dying.
Well, I thought that as the red states got infected, because early on, very early on in March, April, etc., one of the reasons why the White House did nothing was that they thought, oh, well, this is affecting only blue states like New York and New Jersey, and our base is in the red states, so, you know, we don't need to worry about that. And then lately, as it's affected more red states, and particularly in the Dakotas, the amazing thing is that in South Dakota, for example, the mayor of Sioux Falls voted against wearing masks, and the governor of North Dakota, of course, is an ardent Trumpster, and she's also in denial. So I guess I thought that when infection started to hit the red states and people started to lose relatives and friends, that the politics would change. But as far as I can tell, it hasn't. So what explains that?
Yeah, no, that's because I think it's such, the feelings are so deep-seated that they haven't been easily reversed. I think that's the problem. Certainly in this state, Iowa did well for a while, and then the number of cases has just continued to increase and go up and up, and hospitals are being overwhelmed. And I think slowly the authorities are making more rules and making things more mandatory. But it's taken a while, and there's going to be many more deaths because of the slowness that it's taken in having some of these very simple things instituted. So this whole idea of masks, you know, early on we didn't think masks were so key, but it's been clear for the last 2 to 3 months or longer that masks are really important. And certainly the Asian countries that have used masks all along have done much better than Western countries have. So, and wearing a mask, I can't believe that's a political statement one way or the other, but that's what it's turned into. So some people won't wear masks because for political reasons. It makes no sense.
But your governor there in Iowa, she's a denier too, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she, but no, that's, what she says is, she says Iowans should make their own decisions. They're really smart, they know how to do it, and that the economics are important. So it's, and the words are not so far off. It's really what you need to do is temper everything. So if she tempered it with the right kind of recommendations, there wouldn't be such a problem. But if you don't do the right things, if you don't close bars when cases are going way up, you don't close restaurants, you don't make people wear masks as opposed to just suggesting it, if you don't tell governors, mayors of cities that they can't mandate masks because she hasn't ordered it, these are all things that are a little more than just being having one side of the argument. It's more being making statements that are really not helpful to controlling a severe pandemic.
Well, just in closing, since you have studied coronavirus pathogenesis for 4 decades, COVID-19 is just the latest, right? There'll be more of these things coming, right?
Well, I think that that's the scary part of what we've learned, is because we thought SARS was finished in 2004. Here this comes in 2020, and it's much worse than SARS because it's so easily transmittable. And then we know that MERS came in 2012, and that's a pretty benign disease. It kills a lot of people who it infects. It's bad in that sense, but it doesn't spread easily. But all you need now is to have a MERS coronavirus that is able to transmit from person to person. And it probably won't be the one that's in the Middle East now. It could well be a new one that arises de novo from camel populations or bat populations in the Middle East or somewhere else. So certainly we have to be aware of this kind of problem and possibility.
Well, Dr. Stanley Perlman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stanley Perlman, who's a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa, who has studied coronavirus pathogenesis for 4 decades. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the alarming growth of the rates of infections and deaths in the United States from COVID-19.
Got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me dizzy, forgetting my body. I watch as it walks away, and I just keep drinking the poison, smoking the cartons, a pack and a half a day. So when time comes to claim me, my friends and my family will gather around my grave. And they'll believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Haywood, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experiences of the adult population. And he has served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology, and currently is a member of the Committee on Population, National Academy of Sciences, and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Haywood.
Thank you.
So, Mark, every day, it seems, for the last few days, the number of infections of COVID-19 in this country just get worse and worse. I mean, they were, like a few days ago, 105, then 136, and then 140,000 plus. Today's figures haven't come out yet. But it's just getting so much worse. And very soon, we'll have 200,000 infections per day. That is a prediction that from very credible sources. So, from your point of view, how do you see this pandemic unfolding?
Well, in terms of unfolding with respect to mortality, we're certainly going to see within a couple of weeks' time the continued upward tick in terms of the overall rates of death that occur on a daily basis. And it'll follow, to some degree, the upward caseloads that we're observing in the population. There will be some disjuncture. It won't be a one-to-one correspondence, of course, because we know the number of cases doesn't equate to the change in mortality. And we have gotten better at handling the kind of mortal or fatal consequences of the virus itself, but there still is a greater risk of mortality by contracting COVID. So we will expect to see a rise in mortality for quite some time, as long as we continue to see the rise of the caseloads, and we, of course, should continue to see a rise even after the caseloads begin to decline, because there is that lag.
Well, at this point, there are more than 241,000 Americans who have died, or people in this country who have died from the coronavirus. And on Wednesday, the U.S. recorded 1,893 deaths. So
right.
This is just alarming. It seems to be out of control. We have a president who is literally AWOL. He's just not even appearing in public, which is an extraordinary for somebody that is addicted to the TV cameras. He's either watching TV or on TV. So we don't have any leadership. How do you see this situation developing?
I think that the lack of national coordination is already showing the implications for people in different states. You have a lack of leadership, actually, at the state level, but that stems from a lack of leadership at the federal level. And the consequences for their populations are being felt right now in terms of the upper Midwest. Some of the places that have fought the regulations on wearing masks, that have fought regulations on how many people can gather in one place at one time. And they've even been fed a variety of pieces of misinformation over that time. And I think that the kind of combination of poo-pooing the ways of social distancing, of how to handle the pandemic, alternative strategies, how to deal with schools, preparing hospitals. Some hospitals now are being overwhelmed because they lack ventilators. That lack of coordination, the lack of resources, the lack of planning is always going to have negative consequences. Here in the U.S., of course, it plays out state by state. That's not a surprise because most pandemics or epidemics or even general health processes play out by state as it is, the pandemic just accentuates state differences in their abilities to cope with health emergencies. And this clearly is a health emergency.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that you mentioned the upper Midwest. The Dakotas are particularly hard hit. And just yesterday, the mayor of Sioux Falls, Dakota, voted against wearing masks. And he's in a town and a state where it's out of control and that they're running out of hospital beds. So what explains this peculiar resistance?
You know, Ian, it's politics. I mean, I hate to say that. It's a situation where politics has gone so far on the kind of conservative side. It's become so antithetical to science. It's become so focused on individual rights at the expense of the well-being of population, of your neighbors and of your family and other people, that it's that kind of stance that I think has been driving a lot of this. And of course, to be honest, I think a lot of that is relatively new. And I think that comes out of the lack of leadership at the federal level. It comes out of someone who has called the pandemic a hoax. Lots of people are still out there thinking that it's not a big deal. They think it is like the flu. And we're talking millions of people that are putting themselves at risk. We're not just talking about Uncle Joe at Thanksgiving. We're talking about millions of people spread across many places.
But some of the statistics and the polling are quite contradictory and alarming. For example, while Americans are less willing to stay at home, the polling results show that they're actually more worried about the pandemic, with 61% saying they believe the situation is getting worse compared to 40% in April. But nevertheless, about 40% of Republicans polled say they are willing to comply with a stay-at-home order, which is down from 74% in the spring. And by contrast, 87% of Democrats say that they would comply, which is a slight drop from 91% back in March and April. So on the one hand, there's a recognition on the part of Republicans that the pandemic is getting worse, but a growing resistance to do anything about it.
Yeah, and they can change their mind since earlier in the pandemic, but the fact that they eventually changed their minds after things became so bad provided the base of exposure that's so high that, you know, that we're really in a kind of situation where lockdowns may have to come. And of course, people will fight those. Right? They're going to be highly resistant to a lot of those, that kind of stuff. And they're not going to be quiet about it. And they're going to be encouraged by political figures. So, you know, when Republicans finally figured out that this was really an important issue in that time period, the case base that has led to our situation now developed, right? You have to move fast and assertively at the beginning of pandemics. Right now, our base is so high that as we begin to escalate, that's why those rates of 200,000 per day are not out of line. We have a base level of exposure and that is going to really drive those rates sky high.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Hayward, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experience of the adult population. He has served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology, and is currently a member of the Committee on Population at the National Academy of Sciences and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. So how much of a factor is the trashing of Dr. Fauci, who has always been the leading, most credible figure in terms of public health in this country? Recently, Stephen Bannon called for his beheading.
Exactly.
So you've got that going on. And on the other hand, President Trump is listening to this quack from the Hoover Institution, who is a radiologist, and yet he's basically replaced Fauci as far as Trump's concerned, and he's advocating for herd immunity, which is most public health officials think is criminally irresponsible.
It is criminally irresponsible. So, you know, and the fact that the government and the administration has allowed the discussion to get so out of hand that Fauci and is under death threats and has to have armed guards is absolutely outrageous. I mean, who would ever think you would get to that point? But if you don't squash those kinds of pieces of misinformation and propaganda and just things that are outright wrong, and in fact, if you contribute to it by proposing different kinds of cures that have no basis in any kind of science, and if you trash science in general, I'm not sure what you would expect other than this horrific situation, right? And just, is some miracle going to come along and say, oh, we hate science, we trash the scientists, we don't plan, we don't set an example, and we put out misinformation, where else would we be?
Well, given that we're in this political limbo at the moment where the president has not conceded and is not likely to concede and is not likely to even attend Biden's inauguration. And if the Republican senators stick to their strategy, which appears to be they want to use Trump as a way to rally their base so that they'll win the two runoff elections in Georgia and maintain their majority in the Senate, that seems to be their priority. So we're not going to have any clarity until after the Georgia runoffs, which is January the 5th. Which will give Biden only 2 weeks of a transition. So at this point, do you think there's anything that we can do? We are just sort of passive spectators to this catastrophe of death?
I think this in places like California, which have a better way of administering public health programs and dealing with these issues, and they're stronger in terms of their messaging and their and the ways in which they are governing and dealing with the pandemic, you'll have a better outcome than you will in places that are like Florida, who is hiring someone that basically runs some sort of, I don't know, gambling routine and puts them as part of the data and analytic team for your state. Right? I mean, which place would you trust? So, I think that in many ways, this kind of irresponsibility on the part of certain, in terms of local and state governments and the federal government, is going to have disastrous consequences. I don't know any other way to say it. I wish I could be more optimistic, but it really, at this point, it's going to take everyone moving in the same direction, because people still don't really grasp that even if it's bad in Minnesota or bad in Wisconsin, it's bad in the Dakotas, eventually it will be bad in other places too. And of course, there's a cycle to these, to what's going on in the pandemic in terms of location. So we're, you know, the different geographies are at different stages in this pandemic as well. And very few people talk about that issue, which is quite unfortunate.
Well, you've got the winter coming, don't you, Mark? And there's a possibility of what's been called the twindemic, which is the COVID plus the flu.
Yes. So let me just say one thing again about that kind of summarizes, I think, what the current situation is. There's really, when you are putting into place a set of policies that advance economics and profits and the economy over everything else, you're going to come out with a situation that looks like this. And I think that is ultimately what has been driving a lot of this. Certainly that kind of prioritization of putting people, not really worrying about people being at risk, but advancing an agenda which has to do with economic power and profits, I think that at the expense of well-being of the population, I think that has been going on in America for a long, long time, and it has now come home to be even more stark when we see it playing out with the pandemic.
But you would think that the public would notice that and be outraged that they're guinea pigs for other people's profit.
I just saw 70 million people vote for someone that doesn't believe in science and uses them and abuses them.
Well, just in closing then, Mark, what... what do you and your colleagues and the work that you do, what kind of projections do you have for the death count by the time Biden takes office? And I'm sure shortly thereafter,
yeah,
the Republicans will blame Biden for the death count.
Yeah, I can't really give you an accurate number right now. And so, ultimately, Ian, it will really depend on a variety of things, like how we get resources into the hands of the providers that need them and whether we can do anything in terms of changes in people's behavior as time goes along. Ultimately, that's really the kinds of factors that are going to move the needle on the kind of mortality outcomes that we're looking at. So I think that I don't want to do a straight line math projection. I know many people do, and I'm just not one of those people.
Well, the figures that are being tossed about are like 300,000. But in closing, my understanding is that the daily death count now is as bad, if not worse, than the daily death count was during World War II in 1944, which was the worst period of the war for the United States.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
Well, that's alarming enough, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, to me it is, Ian. I suspect it should be to a lot of people.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Mark Haywood.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Haywood, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experience of the adult population. And he served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology, and is currently a member of the Committee on Population at the National Academy of Sciences and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves, standing along the side of the pickup truck. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and the slant hill of the free. When time was night. The other became a car. A car.